Hello there and welcome to the special edition of Straight Talk Africa. We are coming to you from VOA studios in New York. Leaders from around the globe are gathered in America's largest city for the 77th session of the United Nations General Assembly. It's the world's biggest diplomatic conference, and this year it takes place against a backdrop of Russia's war in Ukraine, multiple humanitarian crises, a global economic downturn, crippling food and fuel shortages, energy shocks, and climate change. And at the start of this year's gathering, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned the world that nations are, as he put it, gridlocked in colossal global dysfunction, and that they are not ready or willing to tackle the challenges that threaten humanity's future. And that is our focus this week. Does a world body that was established nearly 80 years ago to prevent war from breaking out, a body meant to promote multilateralism, peace and stability and economic development, does it have the will and the power to confront and solve today's global crises? And my guests are standing by here with me to discuss this. But first, we go to VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir. She is at the UN headquarters and joins us now. Margaret, great to see you. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has lamented the geopolitical tensions and divisions among nations. Are you seeing signs of those tensions already playing out at this year's UN General Assembly?
Well, I think we've been seeing these divisions and tensions for a while. The Secretary General pointed out Tuesday when he opened the annual meeting that we are seeing divisions and inequalities between North and South and between the West and the global South. And I think we saw that last year with the COVID-19 pandemic, with the rollout of the vaccines. They went very quickly to developed countries, wealthier countries. They took a lot longer to trickle down to Africa and to other developing parts of the world. We are seeing it with climate change. Countries that are emitting the most greenhouse gases are hurting countries that are not big emitters. We're hearing about that in speeches yesterday from leaders. And now, of course, with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there's obviously a Russia versus the West divide. But there's also this feeling among some countries, particularly in the global South, we're hearing it from African leaders, too, that there's this pressure, perhaps, to pick a side. And we heard Senegalese President Macky Sall on Tuesday. He's also the African Union chairperson. He said that Africa suffered enough and they don't want to be caught in this new Cold War. So there's definitely vibrations, and we're hearing about these various divisions that are in the world.
Margaret, very briefly, you mentioned some of the issues taking center stage. Is there confidence among countries that the UNGA is still the place, or is the place where things can get done?
Well, I think Haiti leaders wouldn't keep coming back year after year if they didn't actually get business done here. It would be a waste of their time. And we see it at the very highest levels, presidents, prime ministers, royalty. So foreign ministers, they all come to the UN General Assembly. They haven't really been here in large numbers since the pandemic. This is the first year everyone's back in person fully. So the real diplomacy takes place away from the television cameras, away from the podium in the General Assembly hall, during these one-on-one meetings that leaders have. For instance, you know, we saw on Monday that the U.S. Secretary of State had a meeting outside this campus with the foreign ministers of Azerbaijan and Armenia. They've had a recent flare-up in hostilities between those two countries, and it provided an opportunity with those three foreign ministers here to try and de-escalate tensions. So it really provides a forum for leaders to get together and talk about these pressing issues. And this year, it's very much going to be about the food crisis, the fertilizer crunch, the energy crisis, the financial crisis, and global inflation is rampant. So there are so many issues to discuss here.
All right, we appreciate your reporting, Margaret. That's Margaret Bashir speaking to me from the United Nations. Margaret, thank you. And we're going to kick off our discussion now. My guests are Franny Lutier. She is the CEO of Southbridge Investment, and she joins us via Skype from the Botswanan capital of Gaborone. Franny, welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure to be here.
And with me here in studio is David Monda. He's a professor of political science at City University of New York. David, no stranger to the show, a warm welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, David, I'm going to kick off the discussion with you. Now, for years, the United Nations has faced criticism about its usefulness. Every year this meeting happens, but what exactly does the UN General Assembly accomplish? And what does it accomplish for African countries?
I'd answer that at three levels. I think it's extremely important that even though the negotiations and talking, quote-unquote, talk after talk continues. But those human people-to-people contacts are very important. It's extremely important that world leaders get to meet each other face-to-face. But let's also not forget that when they meet, a lot of the lower cadre of the diplomatic corps also get to interact. So that human people-to-people contact is also very important. I think in terms of global agencies like the UN, it's also been extremely important, not only in terms of getting an international voice together, but a lot of its agencies, whether it's on climate change, whether it's specialized agencies on gender parity, whether it's specialized agencies on climate change, whether specialized agencies on international development. These are really important frameworks, and it's important to continue this messaging and this communication within the United Nations family, and particularly at the heads of state level, but also more particularly at the foreign ministers level and the interagency level for all the UN, different UN affiliate agencies.
Franny, I want to bring you into the discussion here. What's your take about how a debate among diplomats, that's essentially political, but how does that lead to economic solutions in the end, especially for many African countries?
I was looking at the major historical debates that had an impact on developing countries and particularly on Africa. And the three that jump out at once are first in 1948, when the Declaration of Human Rights came out of the UN General Assembly. That has shaped the way we see human rights in Africa, the impact that it has on development, and the way it shapes the dialogue of inclusion, particularly economic inclusion. And then, of course, there is the work that took place in the 1960s, including supporting the countries who are looking for independence. Tanzania got its independence peacefully through a discussion at the UN. So that was a major contribution of the General Assembly once again. And then more recently, in the 2000s, with the Millennium Development Goals, which then became the Sustainable Development Goals, that has given Africa a great opportunity to now look at how it can position itself to use the opportunity for new technologies, new ways of generating electricity, the new digital economy, and benefit from this transformation that allows Africa to develop differently as a result of the climate crisis, while at the same time negotiating with other countries on getting more contribution to support Africa's transformation in the climate crisis. So these three big discussions, I think, had a major impact, not only on Africa, but on other parts of the world.
Talking about laying out positions and taking positions, David, we're seeing some notable absences this year. Mm-hmm. The leaders of China, India, South Africa, Ethiopia, Russia, of course, and we know why with some of these countries. But that represents quite a significant portion of the world population, their leaders not here. What do you read into these absences, especially by Russia, China, India? And what does that say about the power of, or what does that say about the UN's convening power?
I think it's a pretty troubling trend, because we know that India is obviously a major global power just by virtue of its demographics, its unique cultural history, its agency in terms of diplomacy, the Mahatma Gandhi sort of philosophical idea of bringing all nations together. But the other troubling challenge there is we see Russia's not present. Russia's a permanent member of the Security Council.
China,
so we have
too.
A huge, a major problem there, exactly. We have China there, not attending. So there seems to be this fissure in terms of the West and the U.S. and its allies in terms of their advocacy. But also the broader question of, you know, is China, India and Russia, are they trying to craft an alternate path in terms of how we'll understand international affairs? Let's also not forget that these are countries that are part of the BRICS. South Africa is part of the BRICS grouping, Russia, China and India. And their lack of not being present, I think, is a major blow to global public diplomacy in terms of how we're really looking to reset this paradigm. Going forward, I think the UN and a lot of our diplomats need to think about how do we narrow this fissure so it's not a question about China and India and Russia on one hand and, say, South Africa against the West and the United States and some of the other more powerful blocs. As you've mentioned, there seems to be this forming dichotomy of you're either with the West and the European Union and Western forces on the Ukraine question, or you're with China and Russia. And I think in terms of the global diplomacy, this would be something that will need to be very carefully nurtured in so that it's not, we don't create a dichotomy where you have two angling sides that are antagonistic to each other.
Freddie, picking up on what David said about these divisions, there is a law right now working through the U.S. Congress. Well, it has already been passed in the House of Representatives, and of course it has yet to be passed by the Senate. But if signed into law by President Biden, it could sanction countries that trade with Russia, and it's called Countering Malign Russian Activities in Africa Act. That's pretty direct. How will this affect the business relationship, which is an extremely important element of international relations? How will this affect the business relationship between Western nations and sort of the rest of the world?
I think, first of all, what helped Africa in the previous Cold War was for the majority of countries that remained non-aligned. And there was a movement of the 77 non-aligned nations led by Indira Gandhi and leaders like Julius Nyerere and others that put many African countries in a neutral position, and that helped them to deal with some of the risks, economic risks in particular, of being on one side or the other. And I think when you look at the number of countries that depend, for example, on grain, agricultural equipment, fertilizers, being able to achieve those solutions requires the countries to deal with both sides. So from an economic point of view, I think that remains very important. And then the second issue, I think, is that Africa is very rich in natural resources that the whole world needs. It has a lot of contributions to the world in terms of its people, talented people with creative ideas. And of course, it's one of the largest continents with 1.3 billion people. So it's very difficult to isolate such a big continent, and economically as well as socially. And that means it's important for the continent to remain neutral in a way that allows it to work with different sides of an argument at every given point in time. Because this time, it may be an economic relation that benefits one side, but things could change and it could turn the other way. So I think the 77 non-aligned nations experience has shown that economically, it's better to deal with economic issues using, of course, the principles of fair trade, human rights, and including...
Franny.
And that helps to achieve the
results. My apologies. We're going to have to take a break quickly. Franny, David, stay with me. We'll continue our discussion on the other side of the break. This is a special edition of Straight Talk Africa coming to you from New York. We'll be back in a moment.
Health, wellness,
sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
We are coming to you from New York, where world leaders have gathered for the UN General Assembly. We're discussing the issues taking center stage at this year's event. My guests are David Monda here in studio with me and Franny Luthier. She joins us from Botswana. Franny, I cut you off a little earlier and I will come back to you. But David, we've seen calls again and again from African nations for a more permanent role at the UN, particularly the UN Security Council. Africa is a 54-member strong voting bloc. That's enough to sway resolutions. Since all the countries represented on the UN Security Council, this is just me and my wishful thinking, since all those countries are essentially courting Africa right now, wanting better relations, saying how important Africa is in the global scheme of things, is now not then the best opportunity for Africa to put this matter front and center and expect some concrete results?
I think this matter has been debated a lot, particularly not only in terms of the diplomatic sense that it makes to have Africa have a permanent seat on the Security Council. But the broader political questions have always undercut the African position. So, for example, who from the continent will represent the continent? Would it be South Africa, based on its economic and diplomatic might? Will it be Nigeria, based on its demographic might? Will it be Egypt, based on its Afro-Arab sort of lingua there?
Can any country be truly representative of a 54-nation continent?
Correct. And I think the other element of it is there the political goodwill within the current permanent members? That's the Chinese, the Russians, the Brits, the French, and the Americans, to really add an additional seat to and give it to Africa. That's, quote unquote, diluting their power. But if I may segue a little bit to what we talked about a little earlier, particularly in terms of the legislation Biden's introducing, I think that's a very challenging position for Africa, because it really creates this dichotomy that African countries have to decide whether they're going to be with the United States or without the United States. And it's particularly challenging because if America sanctions certain companies that are doing work in Africa or with Russia, then what does that do to the investor climate? For example, does companies, would they be afraid with doing trade with, say, Kenya or South Africa or Gabon, and fear maybe the repercussions of doing business with a Russian allied company that the United States is not happy with, right? So this is other economic imperatives. But I think going forward, when we really think of the UN General Assembly and how do we create environments where all these different interests can come together. And I think this is a very difficult and challenging position, particularly for Africa and for the Secretary General. As much as we look at the Secretary General position as very autonomous, the Secretary General is really the Secretary General of the world. He really has to push and deliver papers between different countries. And he cannot at any point be seen to be antagonizing either of the major powers. This would be the Russians or the Soviet Union or China, because they can cripple, you know, any efforts from the UN Secretary General's office if he's seen to be biased either for the Russians or for the Americans.
Freddie, I want to get your take on this. Given the political and economic importance of Africa, is now the time to bring up this issue of UN Security Council permanent seat?
I think it's absolutely the right time. Why? Because most of the conflicts that are taking place are happening on the African continent or have a big impact on the African continent. The U.S. Security Council has a bigger voice, bigger than the General Assembly, and therefore it's an important place to be. At the moment, of course, you have Kenya, Tunisia, and Niger who are representing Africa on the Security Council, and come January, it will be Gabon and Ghana who are replacing Tunisia and Niger. I think it's really important also because Africa has amongst the most challenging problems to resolve resulting from climate change, and also requires to trade with the rest of the world, and therefore peace and security are key elements to sustain that economic development and trade. So I would say if Africa could be represented by the African Union, that would then resolve the problem of which country should represent Africa on the Security Council.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Franny Lutier and David Mond, it was such a great pleasure to have you here on the show. Thank you so much for your time and your insight. I really do appreciate it. Now, food security has been near the top of the agenda at the UN General Assembly this year. Some of the cascading effects of the global economic downturn are skyrocketing food prices and growing hunger around the world. The president of the African Export-Import Bank wants Africa as a region to develop homegrown, sustainable solutions to address food shortages. Benedict Orama spoke to VOA's Peter Clotty on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly.
The problem with food aid is that it creates dependence. I'm not saying that when we are in dire need that people can't come to help. But we should rejig the way we do that so that in that process, we build a foundation to make sure that we say never again, we don't have to rush to help again. So what is done today, although it's beginning to change, is that when we have famine, we have extreme hunger crisis, donors rush food from all over the world, but they do not get it from Africa. So what that has then done is that people give the food they have, those who are donating give what they have, and over time, our tastes have changed. What it then means is that we've developed a taste to eat the cheap food that has been donated, so we are no longer cultivating ours, what we normally eat. So it has created huge import dependence. So when we don't have money to pay for the import, we go hungry again. Not because we cannot produce, but because our tastes have changed and we are import dependent, and we are not able to generate the foreign exchange to continue to import those things. So we have recurrent food.
So, Dr. Orama, what specific steps do you think African countries can take to reverse this or correct this?
It doesn't have to be only African countries. It has to. That's why I gave you this background gave earlier. It also has to go global, or the donor community and the African countries. Africa is a huge continent. As a matter of fact, as you talk about food farming here, in other parts of Africa, there are surplus. The problem is that we're not moving those surplus from other parts of Africa to where you have scarcity, as will happen normally in a country. So what we are saying is, first, to stimulate overall food production on the continent, the donor community, if there's a food crisis in one part of Africa, they should try to supply that part from other parts of Africa where you have surplus, before you start going out if you don't have enough. The second thing is that the demand created by the donor community and also ourselves should be enough to also stimulate production of food in many parts of Africa. What we've done, and we and WF World Food Program have done something unique in this area. In July, we entered in a memorandum of understanding ourselves, Afreximbank, WFP, and Africa Continental Free Trade Area Secretariat. That MOU is in an amount of $2 billion. So we are doing, jointly with WFP, a blended financing to enable us to provide funding to small growers in Africa and the commodity traders to make it possible for WFP to then buy from them to supply parts of Africa where we have food problem using AFCFTA rules and protocols.
Peter Clotty there speaking to Mr. Orama. David, just a quick question. We see climate change, a big topic, of course, this year, every year, in fact. But this is having real and very real consequences for people and impacts, especially in places like the Horn of Africa, intensifying conflicts, exacerbating food insecurity. What do you want to see come out of this meeting that can actually address what we're seeing in places like the Horn of Africa?
Well, I'd like to see a re-emphasis on food security questions, particularly in line with the strategic development goals, the SDGs, which are due in the next 7 years or so, but also the broader Africa Agenda 2063. But I think the other element we need to think about is the Conference of African Heads of State on the Climate Change Crisis. That's going to be going on in New York, and I think this would be a very important framework to address issues of climate change, but also thinking more progressively around how climate change issues. We're going to have the conference in Egypt this year, which is a major, major
COP27.
So hopefully this will be more of a bigger highlight in terms of how do we, you know, address food insecurity issues in the near term, sort of diplomatically. How do we engage Russia and Ukraine so that we reduce the tension and cost of food prices and energy more broadly? But I think going forward, also thinking about the crisis in the Horn of Africa, how do we allow science, UN age specialized agencies on food security to be able to leverage a lot of the resources they have to mitigate some of the crisis we have with food insecurity? And obviously, lastly, we cannot talk about food insecurity in the Horn of Africa without security issues in terms of people security. People have to be safe. So thinking ahead about what the AMISOM force will be in the Horn of Africa and how can we then regulate that to ensure that we have environments where farmers can actually go and grow their crops without fearing that they might be dead at the end of the day.
Well, these are pressing issues. I really hope, and we say this every year, I guess, that this year we will see some concrete solutions. But as Antonio Guterres said, we are at a time of peril. I don't want to depress people, but we have to keep it real, don't we?
Exactly.
David Monda, I do thank you for your time. Thank you for coming
so
out. It was great to be here in person with you one-on-one. I do appreciate it. Right. And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you to my guests, to everyone who helped make this broadcast possible. Thank you to you, our audience, for always watching and always listening. And from our teams in Washington and New York, do go well. Goodbye.